Welcome everyone to the Undisclosed Addendum. We've got two great sponsors today, our most secure sponsor, Simply Safe, and our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. In this latest episode of Undisclosed, part one of the Alabama Highway, we looked into the one man who many people believe would be the most likely suspect in this case, Heath Wilson, and just how strong the evidence was that caused the police to rule him out. With us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group and blogs at The View from LL2. Hey, Susan, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good.
Thanks for being here. We also have Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project. She's an attorney and the interim director. She blogs at georgiainnocenceproject.org. And prior to the GIP, she worked several years as a public defender and as a policy lawyer with the Government Accountability Project. Hey, Claire.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. We also have with us Sarah Brewerton-Palmer. She's an associate with the Kaplan Cobb Law Firm, focusing on complex commercial litigation and appellate matters. Before joining Kaplan Cobb, Sarah served as a law clerk to the Honorable Jill Pryor of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. Sarah has also volunteered her time as a law clerk to the Orleans Public Defender. Now, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the reason we're having you on is that Kaplan Cobb is currently the law firm that's handling the suit that's demanding the audio recordings of the Joey Watkins trial. Is that correct?
That's right.
So, as I've said in the past, to a layperson, it seems like, well, a recording of a trial is a public record and there's no reason for them to turn over those recordings. What are the specific grounds that you guys are approaching in this lawsuit?
I think your interpretation as a layperson is what we would want to have happen in this suit, which is Undisclosed should have free access to these tapes because they're part of the court record just like anything else. But how we're approaching it from our perspective is there's a lot of cases, and I know Colin has mentioned before, the Nixon case is one that we're relying on specifically that talks about a public right to access and copy court records. You know, it includes the words "and copy," and so we should be able to copy the trial audio. So we're using that case and a couple other cases like it as a common law right. And then there's also sort of a corollary First Amendment right. Essentially, if the press can't copy records, then they can't really do their job properly and can't keep a good eye on the court system to make sure it's functioning the way that it should. So that's how we're approaching the problem.
Yeah. And how far does it go based on the trial court and now the DA in Floyd County are saying, I mean, you could ban someone from going to a court looking at a paper record and like writing down what it says.
One quick update, the Floyd County Prosecutor's Office recently filed a brief opposing our motion in the Georgia Supreme Court and kind of doubled down on what the judge did and have even gone a little further so that the judge said that we didn't have a right to copy, but you could go in and listen to the tapes, which obviously doesn't do us much good and wouldn't do much good in a paper record that you couldn't, you know, take a Xerox of and take it away. But the Floyd County Prosecutor's Office has also said that the judge didn't even have to let us go in and listen to the tapes because a transcript would be sufficient. So they've sort of doubled down and gone even a little further.
Has the subject of transcription errors come up at all in the filing?
It has not in the filing. I know that that is something that we've talked about with Susan and Susan's talked about on the podcast and is definitely a big concern. I believe it's another issue raised in another case currently before the Georgia Supreme Court right now. So I think they're hearing argument on that in January. So that will come up. You know, generally judges try to get around that by saying, go listen to it. If you find an error, you know, write me an affidavit and then we can have a fight about whether the transcript is correct.
But so that would be you writing an affidavit saying, I believe in the transcript, it says this, but what I heard here was something else.
I listened to it at the courthouse and it didn't seem to match up. And then, okay, well, maybe, you know, you might have more of a chance to copy something after that. But that's a really high burden. So,
yes, it also depends on you just being able to sit in a room and physically write this stuff down as well. I mean, it inevitably opens up, you know, if you obviously are working from the same record as the judge, that you're actually sitting there with a recording of it, you would be in a much stronger position, I would imagine.
And it's more efficient, too.
Yeah. And the potential for this to apply to paper records is really serious.
Yeah, that's the worst part. I was thinking, like, man, if we lose this case, then we've effectively taken away the right of everyone in Georgia to have copies of court records.
Well, I hope that's not our legacy.
Yes, nice going, Undisclosed. So actually, Sarah, can I ask how you came to be involved in it?
Yeah. So one of the partners at our law firm, Mike Kaplan, got an email from a friend of his telling us about this case. And I have a background in journalism. My undergrad degree was in journalism. So I have a soft spot for First Amendment and the press.
Well, a lot of Americans have a soft spot for, you know, the Constitution.
That's correct. I do like the Constitution. So I jumped at the chance to work with Undisclosed when the email was forwarded to me. So
yeah, and there was the podcast connection here because Mike Kaplan was the attorney for the case on Breakdown season one.
So where does it stand right now? As you said, there was a motion opposing the brief.
Yeah, so we filed a motion asking the court either to amend the order outright, in particular because the Floyd County Prosecutor's Office didn't actually respond to our motion in the trial court. So, you know, and obviously Joey joined it, so there wasn't any opposition. So we asked the court, just go ahead and fix this. And in the alternative, asking them to let us fully brief it like a normal appeal up to the Supreme Court. So we filed that the first week of November. The Floyd County Prosecutor's Office, about 2 weeks ago, filed a response telling the court that they shouldn't do that. And we have not heard anything so far from the Supreme Court, but I'm hopeful that in the next, you know, couple of weeks, we could get an answer, either just amending and giving Undisclosed access or hopefully allowing us to brief the issue further.
Yeah, it's not common at all for a party to not even file a response of any sort for the trial court and then suddenly pipe up on appeal.
Yeah, it's very unusual. They also technically only had 10 days to respond, and they responded about 3 weeks later. So that's out of time. And typically the Georgia Attorney General's office handles things like this. At least that's my understanding. So it's a little bit unusual for them to not say anything in the first instance in the trial court and then come back and do this in the Supreme Court. So
yeah, I mean, this is a serious policy issue. It should not be. It should be given due attention and decided with the understanding of how serious it really is. What Lee Patterson, the Floyd County DA, is saying here is that she wants to take the right from all Georgians to check out court records. And like I said, this doesn't affect just us. It could affect everyone in Georgia going forward. So yeah, it's concerning to see him take a position like this.
One thing that I was surprised by is that their filing doesn't actually discuss any, you know, specific privacy interests that Joey might have or that the state has in this particular recording. It's very broad and just about, you know, this rule says this and you don't have a right to copy anything. So,
but what does the rule actually say?
So the rule doesn't say the word copy. It says, I believe, access. Is that right, Susan?
Access and inspect.
Inspect is the word it says. So the rule says you have a right to inspect court records. It does not say copy. So a lot of the cases like the Nixon case and a lot of the other cases that we've been citing kind of say that, you know, a right to inspect includes the right to copy because the public can't really do what it needs to do with court records if it can only inspect them and can't copy them. It's sort of a meaningless right if you don't get to copy something.
So as of now, who are the people who have actually filed opposing briefs to this?
The Floyd County Prosecutor's Office.
Got it. And their grounds were it's just not in the rules.
Yeah.
Got it.
Hi, listeners. Y'all know this. Home security is incredibly important, especially around the holidays. Think about it. You're storing up all those gifts that you're going to give friends and loved ones, and you want to make sure that you keep them safe. That's why Undisclosed is recommending that you pick up SimpliSafe Home Security for your security this holiday season. SimpliSafe is having its biggest holiday sale ever. Right now, you can get a whopping $200 off SimpliSafe's special holiday security package. It's an award-winning alarm system that has everything you need to protect your home. So typically the alarm system runs for about $600, but with this special offer, it's $400. This is the biggest deal that SimpliSafe has ever offered. Here's the best part. No long-term contract, no installation costs, no hidden fees, ever. This thing is super simple to set up. In fact, I made a little video to show you how easy it is that we're gonna share on the Undisclosed social media accounts. So check it out. But for right now, here's what I really want you to do. Go to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com and you're going to get that $200 off special offer. Here it is again, SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com for $200 off your security system. Hurry up, sale ends soon. Go to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com.
And this episode of Undisclosed actually was all about records and record keeping. My questions actually about this particular episode were mostly about the Sally records that were discussed. Is it that the Sally records no longer physically exist or that they can't be found or that we just don't have access to them?
So the Sally records, I'll just kind of briefly explain what those are and how they work back in the time frame. So you've got the 911 kind of war room, basically, where all the operators sit around and there's calls coming in from several different lines. And there's, at the time, there was not computer-aided dispatch. It was manual dispatch, which is why you've got all the handwritten radio traffic logs and all of the handwritten cards. The only thing that was computerized, or one of the only records that was computerized associated with 911 at the time, were these SALI records. And I believe SALI stands for Standalone Location Identifier System or something like that. And basically, the way it was described to me by several of the witnesses with whom I spoke was that there was this, like, printer in the back of the room, and one of those old-fashioned things where the pages would come out folded with the little, you know, white tabs on the side that you would
like
pull
the holes.
Yeah,
yes,
that you had to peel off every time.
Those were fun.
and so that would just constantly, there was no human intervention there. It would just constantly spit out information as the calls came in. And the information recorded was basically what Susan talked about in the podcast, all kinds of different information about the address of the call, the time it first hit the main system and then hit the local 911 system, and what station picked up the call, and all kinds of information like that. Now, that information was boxed up and sent off somewhere, but we can't figure out where. We don't know if it was stored within 911, because nobody seems to remember from back then. But what we believe is that it was not sent to Central Archives in Rome, which is where all the cards and the radio traffic records were sent, because I spoke with the man who runs the archives facility, and he didn't have any records of that stuff ever being stored there. But we do know from speaking with witnesses that police would routinely pull these SALI records to get the computer-generated documentation and information about the calls. And we also know that someone went and pulled the SALI records from this night just in that time frame that Susan talked about, that is really way past both of the shootings. So the question that we were asking is, where's the rest of the records? First, what are the odds that no other SALI records were pulled that night? And I personally believe the odds are very low that no other SALI records were pulled that night. If they were pulled, where are they? And if they don't exist anymore, is there any way we can retrieve that information again? So we don't know if they were pulled, and we don't know where they are if they were pulled. We do know that we cannot find the old SALI records. If they were stored in retention, which we don't think they were, they would have been destroyed 7 years after being put in retention, unless they were pulled. I mean, they could be somewhere now. We just don't know where. I even tried to track down the old computer that was kind of feeding the information into and out of the SALI system, because apparently the kind of raw data used to be stored on that, and that computer has long been destroyed, and that information just cannot be found anywhere. So, long story short, we cannot find those records.
So it actually doesn't exist as a computer record? It only exists as a printed record?
I believe it did exist as a computer record back in the day, though they might have only archived it in paper form, but we don't have the paper or the computer record at this point.
So it sounds like this system isn't even in use anymore?
No.
No.
Yeah, well, I mean, as much fun as it is to pull those perforated things off the edge, I can see why they might have gone away from it. To me, honestly, 7 years, I understand that there's an enormous amount of records generated, and, you know, you've got to put all that somewhere physically, or, you know, store it in computers. But 7 years feels kind of short to me. It seems like with the incredibly glacial pace of court proceedings, that maybe people need to look at that policy. Has anybody talked about that?
My understanding is that when records are pulled for murder cases and things like that, this stuff is retained for a longer period of time. And that may well have been the case. But that's after stuff has been identified and pulled out from retention as identified as associated with a criminal case. If it's not extracted at the time, just like 911 tapes used to be recorded over, if you don't pull the information within anywhere from 30 to 60 to 90 days on 911 records, they're often lost for good. And same with the retention. Like if you don't identify this as something that is associated with a murder conviction or a criminal case, then it's just subject to the routine retention and destruction time frame that they have.
Yeah, I think the theory is that the records related to a murder would actually be in the murder file,
which now, is retained for longer.
What are all the types of records being kept? Because you mentioned many, many different types. And sometimes I'm unsure as a listener, wait, which ones are you referring to? Because some of them have sort of overlap areas, because there's the radio logs, there's the dispatch cards, there's the 911 calls, which I imagine are audio. But then there's also the Sally records of the 911 calls. And then there's also recordings of radio traffic, is my understanding.
So you've pretty much covered all of them. The calls come in, and there was an audio recording made of the calls and the conversations, you know, taking place between the dispatcher and the 911 caller. So when a criminal case, or, you know, when investigators wanted to look into a case, they would request that 911 audio recording. So that's one of them. We have two calls on the 911 audio recording, and I'm sure they're going to talk about this in the next episode, and I'd be happy to talk about it now, but there's something very off about those two 911 recordings. Then the second thing that goes on is there's an audio recording made of what's called the radio traffic, and that is the communications between the dispatcher and the government entity or the police, law enforcement, EMS, whoever, with whom they are communicating. So all of that kind of code speak with all the numbers and everything is being actively spoken out to the receiving end. And all of that's recorded. You can request that and listen to that as well. So those are two forms of it. Then the other thing that's happening back at the time, it's different now with the computer-aided dispatch, but back at the time, is the 911 dispatcher who's taking the 911 call and dispatching out who is supposed to respond to that call is taking notes by hand in two different forms. On one form, they are recording the radio traffic. It's basically just like a spreadsheet with the time and the subject of the call, what dispatch was communicated, and who responded and who the dispatcher was. So that's all recorded in contemporaneous notes on this radio traffic log. Then there are cards, and on the dispatch cards, they just document who the caller is, what the caller is saying, and who was dispatched and who dispatched the responding agency. Oh, and then there are the Sally records, which are the computer records. So we should, in any murder case, in any standard police investigation, my understanding in speaking with the witnesses is it was routine for all of these things to be pulled.
And they often had overlapping, if slightly different, information.
Right. And the question, in my opinion, is best evidence. I mean, what is the best evidence of the time that Wayne Benson called 911? Is it the handwritten card? No, it's the Sally record. So why was that not what's introduced at court? I'm not sure.
And the Sally record was actually introduced in Heath's trial, correct?
I don't know if it was introduced. I don't think it was actually a trial, but it was in his investigative file.
Now, do we know if the police looked at the Sally records or just that they didn't put it into evidence?
Supposedly, they never pulled them.
Well, and I would take issue with that because the Sally record that we do have in Heath Wilson's file, there's no record that they ever pulled that. There's no written request for the Sally record. It's just there in the file. So just because the Sally records are not in Joey's file does not mean they weren't pulled.
In terms of tapes, like the actual audio recordings, there's two kinds, like Claire said. There's the actual 911 calls, and then there's the radio chatter between like dispatch and the officers. We only have two 911 calls, and we have none of the radio traffic, which they could have easily requested. So, and those do have forms they use to request it, and we have one for another issue in November. So there's no evidence they requested it here, but come on, they had to have, right?
The other thing that's really weird, the 911 calls themselves are very odd. You know, as a former public defender, I mean, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of 911 calls, and in all of them, they're made the same way. And that was in Washington State. But my understanding in speaking with several people, 911 operators here, they were made the same way here, which is that the record custodian is given a request. For example, pull all the 911 calls associated with the shooting of Isaac Dawkins that night, or from X time to X time that evening, or, you know, whatever the parameters. And so then the records custodian, the 911 records custodian, goes, they identify those calls and they pull them all together and put them on a tape. And they begin the tape saying, you know, this is so-and-so 911's custodian of record. This is a recording of all of the 911 calls from X night. This has been requested by X person. This is the time of the first call. This is the time of the last call. And then all the calls are put on the tape. And then at the end of the tape, it says, this has been a recording by so-and-so, compiled by so-and-so, at the request of so-and-so, and this recording is now complete. And it's really standard the way they do it, and it's sort of self-authenticating. And what we've got on this is none of that introductory stuff. Like, you listen to the tape, and boom, the first thing you hear is what appears to be Wayne Benson. And then the second thing you hear is a woman who is obviously calling 911 for the second time, because she's kind of crying and hysterical, and she's saying, I just called a minute ago. And she's also talking about...
Was she crying or was it a dog?
Well,
one of the 911 operators thought that the noise at the beginning could have been a dog in the car with her, so we're still not sure.
I think she was crying, but Cynthia thinks it was a dog. But what she's saying is important, which is, I just called 911 a minute ago. I'm calling back. And she's also actively referencing other people who are on the phone with 911 at the time. So those are at least two other calls that should be on that 911 tape that aren't. So that tells me that, I don't know, I mean, the person who compiled them didn't compile them all, didn't follow procedures in making the tape, or the tape that we have is not the actual tape that was created.
What was the situation that the woman was referencing?
Isaac's wreck.
Oh, it was Isaac's wreck. Okay. But obviously the reason they would put an identifier at the beginning of a tape and at the end of a tape would be so that you couldn't truncate the tape and act as though some of it wasn't there.
Right. And also to document that all the 911 calls were sort of searched and collected and compiled there.
It's all a mess. And it's that's kind of what it comes down to. And like, it's frustrating because it would give us so many easy answers here that we'll never get now. And it's hard to think of a good reason why they would have failed to do this.
I don't believe they failed to do it.
Or that.
So how complete are the records? Because you have gotten some of the records of the police investigation, clearly, over the course of this season. We've heard a lot of very specific references. Is there any way to figure out how complete the records of the investigation are that the police have handed over?
Well, we've got Rick Latta, the fellow working on the case, who's up there trying to make sure they hand over everything. And it's hard to say because there are so many references to other things and documents we think should exist, but we don't really see any evidence of. We have more than we did a year ago, that's for sure.
Well, and then the other thing is kind of how things were organized and stored. When everything was mainly on paper and still hasn't been scanned in from what we know, things get misplaced. Like even in Joey's file, you go pull Joey's file and there's some death penalty case in there in an orange folder, which is not at all related to Joey's case. Like nothing seems to be connected to Joey's case. It's just been misfiled. And so documents get lost, they get misplaced, they end up on someone's desk and stuck in a drawer. And so Rick has recently been going and sort of requesting huge chunks of documents just to kind of see everything that was, like, for example, all evidence inventory sheets for a 1 year time span. And in reviewing those, he's been finding additional information.
Yeah, it's paying off. I mean, it's the hard way of doing it. He's just going there and saying, hey, Floyd County, give me your whole damn year of documents and I'll go through it and find the ones that matter. And they're there. It's just they've either not been able to find them or haven't looked.
I have to say I'm worried about that death penalty case that you found in there. I'm hoping that isn't incredibly important information to the person, you know, on death row, perhaps, who might have needed it.
He's not on death row anymore, so.
So when you do find stuff that's misfiled, is there any way for you to get it filed properly?
I'm sure that we could report it, identify it to the people, and just let them know that it needs to be filed properly.
Well, that would work. Now, I have to say, listening to the process by which the 911 operators work, it gave me an enormous amount of respect for 911 operators. I always assumed it was just their job to, you know, take down the basic information, dispatch the police, and that was it. I did not realize that there was so much record keeping involved.
I've come to the same conclusion in this, and I have just the most tremendous respect and awe of 911 operators, especially back then when everything was handwritten and they got all these calls coming in at the same time. And, you know, it's just fascinating the way it all works. And then you can look at their notes and you can see that they were sitting right there for a 3-hour stretch with information just pouring in, and they're writing things down and dispatching things out and not getting up for a bathroom break. And it's a hard job.
And it sounded like Virginia was talking about that she overheard most of that information. So you're also taking in information that's coming over other people's radios.
Yeah, she was a supervisor. So it was her job to in addition to doing her own dispatching and record keeping, to keep track of others.
And the operator who took the particular record of Joey Rhodes' call, Cindy Collum, it's alluded to in the show that she didn't last particularly long as a 911 operator.
We're not sure if she was asked to leave or just left on her own. All we know is that she was not there for very long.
I have to imagine as a job, it would be kind of wearing and or terrifying to, you know, hear people in states of real dismay and, you know, and having incredibly important information to have to be relayed through you. I can't imagine it's a job for everybody.
I would be the worst dispatcher ever.
Well, you talk so fast.
I got that part down.
Exactly.
And if you had any kind of dyslexia or anything, you'd be in real trouble.
God forbid your O's and your 2's look similar.
So, Claire, I will say most of the internet so far is agreeing with me that it was a 0, although I'm not sure it's 0 anymore.
Well, yes, I only have the information of that one card that you tweeted out. And it looks like a 0 to me because the ends are so close to meeting.
And also 2's don't look like that.
And 2's don't look like that. And the other 2's, although her 2's are all over the place.
Actually, so there's 3 different handwritings in that card. And her 2's are pretty consistent. Other than the 2 times she does that crazy 0-2, she just does the backward Z.
Now, Joey Rhodes, now at one point you talk about how difficult he is to talk to. I'm assuming that was the one who didn't show up at the coffee shop and also won't get back to you, Susan?
Yeah, well, Claire and I were at the coffee shop that day because Claire talked to him and he agreed to talk or to meet with her. But then that never happened. And now he is very not interested in talking to us. So we can't really figure out what else might have been. Because all we have is the audio from his trial testimony, which didn't get into a lot of questions that would be helpful to know about.
Well, and I was curious. So it was Joey who ended up stopping at the, was it a gas station where the bobtail driver was almost involved in the altercation?
Joey Rhodes was not there. But yeah, that was where.
Oh, that was not Joey. Oh, that was Joey?
That was
Scott Reinhart.
A lot of names.
Okay, got it. And first of all, what is a bobtail?
It's like the part of the semi-truck that doesn't have the back part.
Wait, what?
It's the part, if you have a little truck that you drive and you attach your cargo to the back, it's without the cargo. I have no idea what the right words are.
Oh, okay. Thank you. We need some sort of glossary for all of these things because I'm lost. So has there been any attempt made to find who the driver of the bobtail was?
Yeah, we've gotten nowhere there. No one wrote the name down. No one remembers the name.
Because it sounded like it got pretty serious.
Yeah. But all we know is that a few days later, Ashley's dad, who was also a trucker, heard talk on over the CB radio about this event. So we don't know who he overheard, but it was just some guy talking on the radio about it.
So it could have been anybody.
Yeah. Any trucker in Rome.
Yes. The other huge mystery to me are why were there 2 911 calls from Heath's at 751 and 803? I mean, it would seem very strange to go home at the end of all this shooting out on the highway. And we know to some degree he was shooting on the highway, even if he wasn't necessarily part of the Isaac Dawkins murder, to get home and then suddenly call 911 twice. indicates something is going on.
Well, we'll have more on that next episode, but spoiler, we still don't know.
Heath was the actual shooter on Highway 20 that night.
Oh, so there is still some confusion. So he wasn't convicted of that?
Well, he was acquitted.
Okay. I'm trying to see if there were any other questions. I think I might go to...
Sarah, do you have any questions
on
this episode?
Yes.
This episode just sort of blew my mind. I'm kind of with Claire that they must have pulled it and then just didn't put it in the file somewhere, because it seems crazy to me that you would not pull those records.
And just given how much time they spent obsessing over the timeline, like, if they believed in their case and they believed it was what it was, then they should have been like, oh, hell yeah, we need those 911 records. They're going to prove Joey's guilt. So
it goes back to the best evidence thing that Claire mentioned, you know. I mean, that is the best evidence, not these handwritten things that you don't really have any ability to prove when anything actually happened.
Yeah, and they spent so much time. It was a hole in their case, sort of. I mean, they used it to their advantage, but there is uncertainty about the time, and the defense did try and be like, hey, guys, look at all this mess here. Why wouldn't they want to clean that up when it'd be so easy to do so?
I can't imagine why you wouldn't want to be like, oh, it's another blue Honda that shot at someone. Maybe we should triple check that timeline, because it's
right. Yeah. Or even that
it was a case.
Or even that you would go to the effort of locating and pulling the Sally records, but then being like, nah, don't give us the records for the time frame of the two shootings just after that, when Heath was calling 911.
Right.
They had to actually request.
It doesn't make any sense.
And then there's the fact that we know in September, so like many months, 6 months after the shooting, for some reason, Sutton went in to talk to Jennifer Conway and requested a 911 recording of just a 911 recording from like 10:30 that night that they thought might be connected to Joey. Which is a whole long story on its own, and it's not connected to Joey. But there was another blue car that had a speeding report, and they were going to accuse like Joey's dad of being involved in the murder and use that as evidence of that. It's a long story. So put that aside. So in September, he's able to go in and pull that 911 tape of that specific call, which, okay, clearly 6 months later, you could still go get these tapes. Why didn't you get the rest of them?
Given the level of depth of the investigation up to that point, you can accuse the cops of many things, certainly Sutton of many things, but not trying hard is not one of them. you know, they clearly were making tremendous efforts in a lot of areas, and it seems like a huge hole in what they were trying to do.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to check in with one of our delicious regular sponsors, Blue Apron. Well, we are in the throes of the holiday season, and if you're like a lot of people I know, you are struggling to find some fantastic and unique gifts for the people you love. Well, look no further. For the foodie in your life who loves to eat, loves to cook, or maybe needs to learn how to cook, Blue Apron would make a wonderful holiday gift. Anyone who gets this gift from you is gonna love you, because every week they've got a box full of fresh, high-quality ingredients that they will be easily able to put together following step-by-step colored recipe cards into incredible gourmet meals. And we're not talking about any old ingredients. We're talking about some of the best ingredients, produce, chicken, beef, pork, that you can get from across the country, because Blue Apron has partnerships with over 150 farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So their seafood is sourced sustainably. Their meat comes from responsibly raised animals, and the produce comes from farms that practice regenerative farming. Imagine sending this gift to somebody in college, or let's say a teenager in your home, because you know what? You can cook together with them, and cooking together builds strong family bonds. It's a fantastic gift for your own family. Not only that, but it comes down to less than $10 per person per meal. And their plans are so flexible that you can customize your recipes week by week. They have vegetarian options. They have such a tremendous variety. Every week you get new recipes. And Blue Apron's culinary team is totally going to surprise you. Recipes are never repeated in the same year, so you're never going to get bored. I'll give an example. Some upcoming meals are Thai green coconut curry with sweet potato and jasmine rice, brown butter and chestnut gnocchi with Brussels sprouts and pea shoot salad. In my house, we have loved every single meal we've ever made with Blue Apron. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/UP. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron and to give those meals as a gift. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I got a question from Aruna on Twitter who says, are you worried about evidence tampering with the 911 logs? The lack of documentation is infuriating.
Not tampering so much as the records we have, the handwritten ones, like they weren't like redone or something. Like by all appearances, they are the legit paper that was written down that night at the time. But we can also see from cards that people did add to stuff. Like other dispatchers would make updates to the cards. So there's no way to say, like, for certain that what exactly was written down when necessarily, but I don't think they were tampered with, other than possibly the fact we lost them in many cases.
But what would an update to the card be? I mean, why would you need to annotate it long after the fact?
So in one case, like the dispatch card for the Joey Rhodes call, we know that a different dispatcher wrote down inbound.
Which, by the way, I don't know what that means.
Oh, like heading into the city. So this was, like, on the Alabama Highway, heading from the west to the east. So they were going into the city when this happened.
And Susan, are you going to go more into that in the next episode?
What part?
Okay, so basically my understanding of what happened, and they talked about this a bit in the episode, was that a call came into 911, like Susan and Colin explained, basically saying that there was an incident at the Kawasaki shop on 27 North, and there's no Kawasaki shop on 27 North, so they had to kind of go back and reconstruct and figure out, well, was this person really by the Kawasaki shop, or is this person really on 27 North? And my understanding in speaking with Virginia and Tony and Sharika was that Virginia Thurman had to go back and talk to Cindy Collum. This is when she pulled Cindy Collum in her office, and they kind of dealt with this issue of trying to figure out what did this caller actually say and where was he and what direction was he heading. Like, if you're going to call out a bolo for reckless driving, you need to know which direction the driver is going. Is the driver heading westbound or eastbound? And so that's the information that came back and was supplemented and added to the card. And so that's why if they're adding information after the fact, without the Sally record, it's impossible to know, did they write down that time the second that the call came in? Or is this something else that was added to the card like half an hour later or, you know, the next day or whatever, when they are trying to figure out what actually happened? So that's what makes that card so unreliable. And yet it is the key reason why the state and Detective Mosier say that Heath Wilson couldn't have done the shooting.
I have a question from Katina Carter, who said, did that lady Cindy still work at E911 when she testified? If so, maybe she lied to save her job. She had to make it look like her records were accurate.
So we do know, though, that she was not working at 911 at the time of her testimony. So that would not have influenced it.
Plus, her testimony contradicted the record she made. I mean, saying that he was being fired at and being chased. By the way, it sounded like he was on foot to me from her testimony. It sounded very exciting. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to say that it didn't sound like fun, but it sounded...
It makes no sense.
Yeah, it sounded nothing like what she recorded at the time. And obviously, you know, there's nobody's memory is perfect, and people make errors on the stand. I imagine there's a lot of pressure. But it didn't sound like... If she was trying to save her job or trying to at least save, you know, people's impression of how she did her job, she wasn't doing a good job on the stand anyway. I have another question. This one from at Healing Dives on Twitter. I think she goes by Diane. She says, why can't they pull the cell phone records of the person who made the 911 call to verify the exact time it was made?
We're working on that.
But those would be Joey Rhodes' cell phone. Wouldn't the police have to have the authority to do that?
Well, you could potentially get it with a subpoena, but we are not sure if the records exist or if that's going to be possible. So we're looking into that.
Because this was 16 years ago and it depends on the record retention policies of his cell provider.
Right.
This one is from Candace Mabra. Since Joey's attorney failed to request the 911 tapes, couldn't that be considered ineffective assistance? This could have established needed reasonable doubt, no?
Well, it theoretically could have, but without being able to show that it would have, that's not going to go anywhere.
And did they request the 911 tapes? I mean, it might well be in their standard discovery request. In fact, I bet it is. And we do know that Rex Abernathy went and tried to locate the cards And when he attempted to pull the handwritten cards associated, well, basically for the whole day, he was told that the entire box was missing.
We've got another question from J.L. Whitaker. Remember the white truck and the Honda? Remember the bit about the pulled off to the side of the road by the guy on the highway in the earlier episode? Is this possibly what the missing call is? That sounded like a road rage report, too.
I think that the person who asked that question might be mixing up the car that was pulled off to the side of the road. Everything that I've come across, and Susan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that car that was pulled off to the side of the road was the small older model blue Honda that was doing the road raging stuff with the white truck. So what had happened was that Isaac hit his brakes to try and lose the blue car. And instead of allowing himself to be lost, the driver of the blue car pulled off to the side of the road and waited for Isaac to start up and move forward again. And when Isaac did, the blue car pulled back onto the road. So that reference to the car on the side of the road is, in my opinion, or my thought, probably not the person who called 911. That's probably the person about whom somebody else called 911 if that call actually took place.
And one thing that we've talked about at some length is Heath's car wasn't actually blue. It was gray. Am I correct?
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Sorry. I opened up a can of worms here.
You really did.
That car.
It depends what light you're in. I mean, that car could be any. It could be blue. It could be gray. People were describing
beige. I've heard black, gray, beige, tan, goldish, brown. It's every color, like, in that and blue.
Isn't it also described as blue in the 911 calls with the Alabama highway shooting?
It is.
Yeah. See, that's like one thing. Okay, the only people I've heard call it blue are Benson and Rhodes's 911 dispatch card, which to me is kind. I wonder if there's a connection there because no one else calls it blue. Now, when Benson saw it, it was very dark. There aren't, like, good lights there. So it makes more sense that he would call it blue. But everyone involved in the Alabama highway incident we've heard from actually calls it, like, sort of, like, grayish tannish. Like an in-between color. Like, kind of, it's not quite gray. It's like a gray with, like, a sort of tan undertone or something.
Yeah, car colors are often combinations of colors. They're often, they look very different in the light because of the way the clear coat is and the way they actually make car paints. That's why they're so difficult to match when you've, you know, had damage to your car and you're trying to get it fixed. I know this from personal experience. and certainly also a lot of automakers use paint colors that are prismatic and change in different light. Could that explain the discrepancy?
Maybe. Well, there's also like a weird. So we didn't have the color copies of the photo of the car for a long time. And Tracy Dunn in her interview says that the car got repainted at some point. So,
Susan, which version of the photo? You say you had a black and white and a color. Which photo did you show Wayne?
So that was the day that Claire and I and were up there with Larry Davis, the PI, and Claire made an appointment to pick up the colored photo from the Floyd County Police Department. It was some kind of holiday, though. I don't know which one it was. So they weren't open and we couldn't get in. And we were there for a while. And we really, really wanted to have the right photo for the Wayne Benson interview. It was the Rome Police Department. So, I mean, we were out of options. So she ended up calling 911 in order to get us into the building.
That was a low priority 911 call.
Yeah, but it was high priority for us because we had an appointment. We needed the photos. And we really wanted to show Benson, you know, good quality photos of it. So we had the color ones. He did see those, yeah.
Obviously, it made a difference because he seemed to recognize it. I've got another Twitter question. This from Allison Snaig, and it says, as a former journalism student, hearing about the role of Richard Rogest's tireless investigator made me wonder, are there many partnerships between journalism and law students and innocence projects benefit both sides? Thanks. This would be a question, I guess, for both Sarah and for Claire.
There's at least one innocence project that doesn't even have any attorneys. It's basically just a journalism project, but they just take innocence project related questions. And then I think beyond that, there's the whole spectrum of relationships with journalists. I think routinely innocence projects have relationships with journalists and journalism students, and therefore any interns involved, law students involved in the project and helping carrying out the mission of the project can also be connected in that way.
So this is something that's happening in a lot of places.
I think so, yeah.
I think it's a natural partnership. When I was in journalism school, we weren't officially partnered with any Innocence Project, but we did cover an Innocence case that was Ryan Ferguson in Columbia, Missouri, in my college town. We covered that case extensively before he was exonerated. I think Kathleen Zellner was his attorney.
Yeah, she definitely works the media.
Which, as we've said, the context in which these cases are viewed is very important. If a prosecutor feels that they're going up against public opinion, they're going to fight much harder. I think they're going to dig their heels in a lot more. But if they go in a situation where the public might accept that somebody didn't actually commit a crime, I think you find a very different attitude. I think that certainly happened in Richard Rogas's case.
Yeah, but I think he's right, too, that they could back away. The DA had the power and like sort of they felt they had the cover to do so, because it's not necessarily because they felt stronger in his innocence, but because no one was paying attention.
Well, yes. Then unfortunately, we're doing Joey a terrible disservice by doing this entire podcast about him.
Yeah, because they have dug their heels in now.
Their heels were dug in before the podcast.
Sure.
I don't think it's any different.
Now they're just more sensitive about it.
Right. And charging us more money to access information.
Yeah. I mean, they get annoyed that we're up there trying to get documents all the time, but like if you just gave us the documents, this would end it. Like, the fact that we have to keep going back to you and going again and again and again and finding new stuff means that we have to do this.
But are they changing the fees that they charge?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's one area that they have some flexibility. So, for example, if we can go pour through boxes of information, then that's time to find what we need. That's time that they don't have to do that. And prosecutors' offices, the GBI, various different entities kind of have what appears to be the discretion to charge or not charge for the time spent locating and then copying documents in addition to the copy fees. So we have recently been told, just like the podcast was told, you have to pay $220 a day to listen to the trial tapes. We've been told to date, actually, I don't believe that Floyd County Police Department or the DA's office or Rome have charged us for location time or staff time, which has been very generous of them. But recently they've started saying they're going to start doing that.
Do you feel like that's something that is recently because of some ill will, or do you feel like it's just that they're now realizing what a big undertaking this is?
Well, I don't know that it's ill will. What was communicated to Rick was that we really can't just have you digging through boxes of information. We're supposed to redact things that you're not allowed to see. And if we are going to be doing that, and you're going to do these expansive requests, we're going to have to put a lot of time into the upfront end. So oftentimes, you know, you can call, you can talk to them about that, you can negotiate, you can try and work out some kind of, you know, request for them to waive your fees since we're a nonprofit and doing free legal representation. But that was the latest communication coming from them because of what they're saying would have to be time to redact and pull out irrelevant documents.
So it sounds like they technically do have a real reason that this might cost them money, but it's up to their discretion to decide when, which, of course, that's rife for abuse, I would imagine.
Yeah. I think more the issue is that they're annoyed that we keep coming back. But again, Claire and Rick have to keep going back because they keep getting stuff they didn't get before.
Well, actually, on a related note, we got a question from Twitter from Kate Rice, who asks, how can people who can't donate money to GIP and are not in Georgia help with Joey's case and other cases like this at the GIP?
Did you say part of that was are not in Georgia?
Yes, that's part of it. This question came to me from somebody who also, I believe, was inquiring for somebody who's still in high school, for somebody who's very young, who obviously is moved to try and help in some way. So I was wondering, are there any volunteering things both in Georgia and outside of Georgia?
There's a few different levels to that. One, depending on the state you're in, you may have a local Innocence Project or some kind of related organization where you can contact them and see if you can donate your time and energy. And another key way to get involved is just to kind of educate people about these issues, talk about the podcast, start discussions with people about the broader, bigger underlying false conviction issues and why these occur. As far as specifically volunteering with the Georgia Innocence Project, we do have if you go to our website, we do have a volunteer page. I think it's under Get Involved, and you click on that. It'll give you this form that's really detailed with a ton of questions on there. And what's happening when you fill that out is all of that feeds into a database. And then when we need a particular service, like someone to help us with our social media or someone to, one thing that's coming to mind is like a transcript summary. If we need a transcript summarized, we'd have to get kind of a confidentiality agreement and do a little mini training program. But volunteers could potentially do transcript summaries for us from afar. But our preference would be somebody here in Georgia. But there are some opportunities. It's just that the way that we identify those is we go through in our database, we do a search for the particular volunteer service that we need. And then everyone who's volunteered in that area kind of pops up.
So people without any experience or particular legal knowledge can actually just show up as a volunteer and help in some way?
Not necessarily show up. They can.
Just show up any hour of the day and night. Just ring your doorbell and
drop in.
They can fill it out on the volunteer page of our website. And there are certain areas, for example, if someone wants to help us with fundraising work, if someone wants to help us with, you know, we could email someone a list of 200 names and ask them to kind of put that in a spreadsheet and, you know, enter some basic, you know, data processing kind of information, stuff like that. We often reach out to volunteers. We reach out to volunteers to help us give exonerees rides places if they don't have a ride. Most of this stuff is Georgia-based, but sometimes you get people helping from across the country, like graphic design issues or whatever the case may be. That said, we currently have like maybe 2,500 people in our volunteer database. And when you do sign up through our volunteer webpage, it'll just send you an email that says, thank you for applying. We don't have a need for volunteers right now. We will reach out to you if we do. And we do. We reach out to people who sign up on our volunteer website. But for the majority of people, that just doesn't happen because we are a small organization. We have very limited resources and we put a lot of effort into legal and law related volunteers, volunteer attorneys, people to help us with the casework. We're kind of building that volunteer program more as we move forward.
But also there are innocence projects all over America and indeed even in other countries. So you can volunteer locally. You can also volunteer with people who help people who are either currently incarcerated or people who are exonerated recently. There's many organizations, and I've actually been able to highlight a few of them on the podcast. So I think there are certainly local opportunities, even if you can't help the GIP from afar.
That's right. And then there's also issues, you know, like starting a monthly movie group and you screen a documentary related to these issues and gather more and more people to kind of just get together and talk about these. And, you know, there's ways to get community involvement at the local level, as well as reaching out to the organizations close to you and in Georgia.
Well, thank you, Claire. Sarah, I was just curious, do you have any last questions for Susan and Claire?
How many more episodes are you guys planning?
I think there's going to be 4. So we're getting close to the end. I'm kind of trying to reorganize things in the hopes that by the time we get to the trial itself, we'll have the audio. But that's in the Supreme Court's hands right now. And you know what? Like, even if we get it, I mean, it'd be great to have it now, but I think it'll be important whenever we get it. Because there was some stuff that was said at trial that I think is really enlightening. So a few weeks ago on the show, before the election, I mentioned there was an Amendment 3 come up in the ballot in Georgia, which would sort of neutralize the Judicial Qualifications Commission. Unfortunately, that passed. Sarah, I was wondering if you've been following that at all?
Yeah, mostly to inform myself as a voter, but it's a very important organization here in Georgia, and I think most of the legal community was tuned into it. It was strange to have the entire state sort of weigh in on this thing that's very particular to the legal community, but I was very sad to see that it passed.
Yeah, Georgia's, the reason why they took it down is because it was so effective in having judges step down. And that's obviously there's a need for that kind of oversight, which is no longer going to be happening the way it did before.
Even I couldn't really understand the ballot question.
Yes, could you fill me in a little bit on it? I'm curious. I don't remember this.
Yeah, the JQC, the Judicial Qualifications Commission, is sort of a, well, it used to be an independent organization that monitored ethical compliance, I guess, on the parts of courts and judges. And they were a very effective force in making sure that, you know, things functioned the way they were supposed to and judges did the right thing and followed the rules and things like that. And so this amendment, I'm not sure of the technical way that it happened, but it essentially gives the legislature more power over the JQC.
The people in the legislature choose the people who get to sit in the commission, basically.
Yeah.
How were they chosen before?
Independent bodies got to choose them, like the Bar Association got a pick, but they weren't basically handpicked by the government itself.
It sounds like an oddly arcane amendment to pass. I mean, most of the time voters go in, you know, and they care about the big races and the big marquee, oh, governor, president, you know, but that seems like an odd, very obscure thing. And generally those kind of things don't pass because people, when they don't understand what things are, they usually vote no, at least here in California, unless it involves pot. Then they're all for it.
Well, the Georgia Constitution has a requirement for an independent agency to oversee judges, which is why I had to go on the ballot. And the way the ballot was written, I honestly think the people voting for it, I mean, they read it and said, oh, this will bring some public oversight to this division. And they must have thought, I mean, I would have thought that there was no public oversight before. So let's do that, as opposed to it being like a downgrade in public oversight or public involvement.
The way you frame these things has such an effect. It's like the slavery ballot measure in Colorado. And the way that it was worded, it made it sound like if you vote yes, there's more slavery happening. And it was the opposite. It was taking, if you vote yes, you take slavery out of the Colorado Constitution. And it didn't pass because it seemed the way that it was worded, people thought, oh God, I have to vote no.
Yeah, like, let's not do that. And the reason why the independence matters is because there is like overlap. And basically now the legislature can have political involvement in these decisions when they shouldn't be political. Whether a judge steps down or not should not be a political question. It should be a question of whether or not they've committed ethical violations. And I think it's really telling that one of the sponsors of the bill was himself an ex-judge who got in trouble for some like Santa-related text to a female attorney and got kicked off the bench and then became a state legislator. And now he's sponsoring this bill to neutralize the body that took him off the bench.
Wait, a Santa-related
like
text?
Ho, ho, ho. Yeah, that kind of Santa.
Okay.
I don't know the exact language he used, but use your imagination.
Okay. Got it. Because I was thinking about, wow, the war on Christmas really has got out of hand. If you even mention Santa in a text and you lose your gig as a judge. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But again, these propositions come up, like in California, we've had opposing propositions, you know, on the same ballot. We had a death penalty. We had two death penalty propositions on the same ballot this year that one said, let's speed them up. And the other said, let's not have them at all. It confuses people. You know, we had probably 15 or 16 propositions we had to vote on. And I didn't know anybody who felt well versed on all of them. Is there any chance that they may be able to reverse this in a proposition maybe, you know, in 4 years?
I suppose it's always possible. It doesn't seem likely.
Yes, you may make the mistake of actually wording it clearly, which might throw people off. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for being here. Such a pleasure. Claire, as always, great to have you. Susan, wonderful to talk to you as well. Thank you all for spending the time on this week's addendum.
Yeah, and Sarah, thanks so much to you and Mike for helping us out with this, because you guys have done – we have the briefs put on our website. Y'all should go check them out. And hopefully we'll hear from Georgia soon and they'll do the right thing. But this is an important issue that goes well beyond just undisclosed and just Joey's case, but a basic right to access for Georgia citizens in general.
Yeah, it's really important.
It definitely is. It's been our pleasure to work on it. And I hope we hear something back soon.
Well, thank you, guys. I think we got it. Founded in 1967, the Fortune Society's vision is to foster a world where all who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated will thrive as positive, contributing members of society. They do this through a holistic, one-stop model of service provision. This continuum of care, informed and implemented by professionals with cultural backgrounds and life experiences similar to those of their clients, helps ensure their success. Fortune serves approximately 6,000 individuals annually via three New York City locations: their service center in Long Island City, Queens, and both the Fortune Academy and Castle Gardens in West Harlem. Their program models are recognized both nationally and internationally for their quality and innovation. Last year, the Fortune Society helped 40 formerly incarcerated people get their GED, 303 people find housing, and 465 people find paying employment. I want to thank Tara Salzman for submitting the Fortune Society, and you can find and donate to them on the web at fortunesociety.org. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDaddendum or just tweet them at me directly at Mr. John Cryer. And remember, there's always our case documents and photos posted at undisclosed-podcast.com. That is your website for all things undisclosed. Whenever you got questions, that's the first place to go. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. Going to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production, Patrick Cortez for composing the addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, our project manager. Once again, thank you so much for allowing me into your phones, your computers, whatever you're listening to the Undisclosed Addendum on. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and I can't wait to talk to you again in a week.